Reed Martin, when you went to University of California at Berkeley in the late 70s?
Allegedly.
You went there with an anticipation of getting a journalism degree, did you not?
I did. I went to Cal to study journalism, and at the beginning of my sophomore year, they dropped the undergraduate journalism program. Well, boy, I was a real brain trust. And then, what did I do? I stayed.
You stayed anyway. And yet, we have a friend from the University of California Drama Department named John Horn, who...
That doesn't really ring a bell.
Is it not ringing any bell? John Horn is not only a graduate of the University of California Berkeley Drama Department, but also now a prominent public radio arts and entertainment journalist.
Amazing.
How did that happen? Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or tablet or phone. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 510, Theater-Trained Journalists. John Horn is the host of KPCC's The Frame, a daily chronicle of creativity in film, TV, music, arts, and entertainment. As you heard, Reed Martin and I went to college with John, so when he and his family visited Edinburgh last month, we swapped microphones. He interviewed us for The Frame, and then we interviewed John for the RSC podcast. He began telling us about his journey from the University of California Drama Department to National Public Radio.
Of course, is that I went to UC Berkeley to be a journalism major as well, and it was canceled in my... might have been my freshman year. What year did you graduate, Reed?
I was there from 78, fall of 78 to spring of 83.
That's the five-year program?
Well, I took a quarter off to go be a professional umpire, and I double majored.
Yeah, I remember that. Double majored in umpire and in theater.
Yeah. Oh, poli-sci in theater, but close enough, yeah.
I was not a journalism major because they canceled it. I was a theater major, and I quickly realized that I had absolutely no hope of making a career in theater. So I went to graduate school like you did, but I went to the University of Colorado Boulevard, also known as Pasadena City College, where I edited the student newspaper, The Courier, and from there I got an internship at the LA Times, then worked at the LA Times, the Orange County Register, the Associated Press, the late great Premier Magazine, the late great, although I still see it on the newsstands, Newsweek Magazine, the Los Angeles Times, and for the last 2 years I've been hosting a public radio show on KPCC-FM, which usually is the number one NPR affiliate in the nation as measured by audience. The irony of the theater degree is that KPCC unionized about 18 months ago. So now with my theater degree, I'm also a member of the Screen Actors Guild.
Congratulations.
Where the dues are greater than any pay increase I will ever get.
Now, John and I did a marvelous show together.
What was that?
I think it was called The Husband. It was a commedia. And John played Dottore.
Oh!
And we lifted one line from that show and put it in our history of comedy, where Dottore says, Felicitas est bonus, nice ass.
Was that your delivery?
That's the only thing I remember that line, yes. And I did the old conjurer. Yeah. And I limped out on my little stage and shirt palsy shake here.
You followed the wrong career path, my friend.
I was going to say, do you get to use this panoply of voices on the radio?
Only in the newsroom and only when it's in our corner, because the panoply of voices are mostly very politically incorrect.
Oh, yeah.
There's the, there's like when we call tech support and it's routed to India. It's like, I am Johnny, here to help you with your problem. What seems to be ailing your computer now? I am the codger. I just don't listen to old public radio anymore. They never tell the stories that I like. Why don't they bring back Jack Benny?
I want them to talk about Alf Landon.
But no, the greatest challenge, and I mean this in all seriousness, is doing a voice that is as natural as I'm speaking to you while I'm reading a script.
Right.
And I have, oddly enough, met with two acting coaches over the course of my employment at KPCC. And the next step, I think, is a therapist, hypnotist, and maybe exorcist.
Well, that's a very interesting notion, because one of the things, when we're looking for actors in the Reduced Shakespeare Company, we're looking for actors who can play, in air quotes, themselves. And that's what radio people do, isn't it? They have a persona that is an extension or an exaggeration of your own, but it has to be
born of you, natural you, but even when you're reading stuff?
Correct. I mean, that's absolutely right. But what you have to do is make sure that when you're having a conversation with somebody and reading a script and introducing a show, that you sound the same. Right. My worst critics, and they're people I work with, say, you know, the guy who does the interviews, can you make that guy be the guy who actually hosts the show?
Oh.
And it's like, yeah, we're working on that.
That's, I screw you.
Oh, wow.
No, I could see that. Constructive, but actually very heartbreaking criticism.
Because you're loose in conversation, right. and there needs to be a looseness in the booth as well.
Yeah. Right, but the difference between a conversation and hosting is you're reading a script. When you're hosting a conversation, I'm just talking to you. I might have questions I want to ask, but it's a very different skill set, even though it's the same person.
Now, in your journalism career, my impression, following you as I have low these many years, is that you were focusing more on the business than the art. The business rather than the show of show business. Is that fair, or have you kind of written about both?
In my LA Times career, I'd say I probably wrote as much about creative people as I did about the business of Hollywood. The difference now is I host a radio show that's about film, television, theater, music, visual art, opera, dance. We cast a wide net. So I am seeing a lot more different. I'm seeing a lot of different shows that I would never see before. Traditionally, at the LA Times, I was doing mostly 95% film. I also was the only person in the paper who covered musical theater.
I'm so sorry.
My degree did serve me well there. I'd say it's always been about the intersection of art and commerce, and sometimes that plays itself out on the way in which creative decisions are made. On the radio show now, we typically favor creative people. We're not interested in studio executives, producers. We want to meet screenwriters, sometimes actors if we're desperate. People who are making, you know, artists, people who are doing actually creative work every day who can talk about their creative process.
Yeah. And you asked us this question when you interviewed us for The Frame, and I'll ask you, what, in kind of seriousness, was how valuable or was it the drama degree, theater degree from University of California, Berkeley?
It was invaluable. I mean, I tried to direct plays in college, which was fun. I think I did a good job at it.
You did. You directed me in Lone Star.
Yes,
the definitive hour and 10-minute version of a 50-minute play.
I think
which is not your fault. It's the actor's fault. I mea culpa.
You just engaged them. but I would say the best thing about my degree is I spent a lot of time doing critical research and writing. And I had some great professors who taught me how to write, taught me how to think, taught me how to look at a text, look at a performance. We probably had some of the same. Richard E.T. White, Dunbar Ogden, yep. Incredible professors, yeah. Who opened my mind to the way to watch and read, and that has served me incredibly well.
Well, and in Richard T. White's case, for me, he was the one who sort of opened my eyes to the large umbrella that theater can contain. You know, I think in the Berkeley Drama Department, things tended to fall into niches, and Richard E. T. White said, no, a rock concert is theater. That's theater. You should be thinking those ways.
No, he said the best theater he ever saw was a Bruce Springsteen concert. The other thing he did, which has served me incredibly well, is the first week I think we were in class, we were in the middle of a Chekhov season that was faculty directed, and one play was worse than the next.
Yes.
And we knew it, but we didn't want to say it. And he came in and essentially said that the chair of the department had just directed the biggest piece of shit Chekhov play that he'd ever seen. And he was probably right, but what was more important is he encouraged all of us to be critical, to say just because the chair of your department has directed a play doesn't mean that it's good, and that you can be critical of people who are your superiors, who are your faculty members, who are the chairs of your department. It doesn't matter who they are. If you think something is bad, mm-hmm. and you can explain why it's bad, it's bad.
That's awesome. And yet you've managed to retain most of the jobs you've had over the years.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened. Maybe I've never said to bosses that they suck.
I do remember those Chekhovs. I just remember the three sisters wanted to saying, oh, go to Moscow. Just shut up and go to Moscow. Shut up.
I will tell you my three sisters' story, and then I must go off to dinner. I was walking into the theater where The Cherry Orchard was playing, and it was directed by a faculty member named Rick Prindle. And for whatever reason, as I'm walking into the theater, I said, about how long is this play? And they said, it's about 3 hours and 45 minutes. And I turned around and went home. Because the only thing worse than 3 hours of Chekhov is 3 hours and 45 minutes of Chekhov.
I'm Robert Siegel, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Always smart, often funny, and invariably brief.
Where can you RSE? The RSE, our fall of 2016 tour of the special election edition of The Complete History of America Abridged, continues across 17 states this week, including Missouri, Iowa, Montana, Indiana, Minnesota, Utah, Michigan, Kentucky, Alaska, Washington, New Jersey, Ohio, Virginia, South Carolina, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Florida. We'll also be touring for 3 weeks in China, and in February 2017, we'll begin our four-month UK tour of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged. We'll have more information about all of our overseas tours later this fall. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information. Now, having spoken with John Horne, I want to play you the piece about Edinburgh that he put together for The Frame. We've talked from our perspective about the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in previous weeks. Here's John's.
During the month of August, there are four main festivals that are in Edinburgh. There's the International Festival, there's an art festival, there's a book festival, but I spent a lot of my time at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. It's a much bigger event. There's a lot more theater, comedy, music, you name it. And they put on shows every hour of the day in church basements, in bars, in lecture halls. There are 1,000 shows every day. But it's why another 500,000 people come to Edinburgh in August. The city's population doubles. You couldn't help but notice how many performers and artists were in the city. It was electric. There are people walking down the street in costume from various shows. There were families. There were people who had traveled. Everybody was there because they believed in what was going on in the city, and what was going on in the city was the most diverse array of performance that I've ever been a witness to. The very first show I went to is called Last Dream on Earth. And as you walk into the theater, you're handed a pair of wireless headphones. This is a show that is telling two parallel stories. It's about the first trip into space by Yuri Gagarin, who is the Russian cosmonaut.
If he makes it into orbit, he will be the first human in space.
And the second story is about somebody who is trying to travel from Africa across the Straits of Magellan into Europe.
Run for the beach.
Halfway down the beach, slam down the dinghy and pump like mad.
300 seconds from rubber to boat.
The boat hits the water.
Two inside now starting to paddle. The others push out and one by one jump in.
And row. Row with all they've got.
If you just kind of stumbled into the show late, you would probably have no idea what was going on, because without the headphones, you really don't hear much of anything. With the headphones on, you become part of the story.
There's really nothing I can put on stage or anything that would get you anywhere close to just putting on a pair of headphones and listen to it like you would have listened on Ground Control or like Gagarin would have listened in the spaceship.
After I saw Last Dream on Earth, I tracked down Kai Fisher, who is the creator of the show.
And then we took this into development and tried that out. And I guess one of the other things that came through for me in the other storyline was two main elements. One is a sort of inner monologue, and the other one, phone conversations. And so it just started to make sense to play with that element of the headphones for the second story as well.
Last Dream on Earth was part of Edinburgh Fringe. The Edinburgh International Festival is a more curated festival. It has fewer shows, and many of them are performed in much larger venues and often by prominent artists. There was a cabaret show, for example, by Alan Cumming. But that doesn't mean these shows can't be just as affecting. The same day that we saw Last Dream on Earth, we went to the Edinburgh Playhouse for a concert called Grit. Here's the story behind the show. Martin Bennett was a Scottish musician, and he died from Hodgkin's lymphoma in 2005. He was just 33 years old. And as he was dying, he recorded an album. It was called Grit, and you're listening to a song from that record. It's called Chanter. Greg Lawson was a friend of Bennett's, and he's a musician in his own right. He's a composer and he's a conductor. And to honor Bennett and Grit, he reorchestrated the entire album for a 70-piece orchestra, and that's what we saw in Edinburgh. And it certainly wasn't your typical symphony setup. There were bagpipes, a couple of drummers, guitars, and a huge bass section. When the orchestra started playing Lawson's new version of Chanter, the violinists started pounding their feet as if they were in a Springsteen concert. The bass players were jumping up and down, and the audience immediately joined in that joy. I hadn't heard a single note from a single song that Bennett had written before I walked into that concert hall. But as soon as the music started, I, like the 3,000 people in the hall, was totally swept away, standing and clapping along with the melody. It was as if I was starting to rediscover what it meant to be something more than a spectator. I was a participant. One of the amazing things about Edinburgh is that if you are willing, you can get up at 7 in the morning and see shows from 7 in the morning till 2 a.m. that night. So there's one morning where I woke up and I really wanted to see something. So I headed over to the Traverse Theater, and there was a woman there. Her name is Steph Smith, and she was working on a show that was very much in progress. It was two actors. They weren't off book. They were holding their scripts in their hands. And the play was called The Girl in the Machine.
You calling me an addict?
Oh, I'm calling us all addicts.
Yeah, well, no one ever died of an overdose on emails, did they?
Well, there's that kid that shot his parents for confiscating his computer console.
That's
those boys who died of sleep deprivation when they didn't stop gaming for like 3 days.
Oh,
and that girl who stabbed a friend jealous of her phone upgrade.
I think that's different.
Is it?
So even though there wasn't a lot of stagecraft, there's no costumes, there's no scenery, there's a little bit of lighting, there's no real music, I have to say, it was an unbelievably intimate show, and you really felt that you were listening to these characters going through this crisis that they were going through.
Yeah, but what if computers could learn taste and craft and expression?
What, a bunch of zeros and ones?
Well, it's just another language. Like trying to explain colour to a blind person. It's just a different way of understanding.
It's too much for me. I can deal with some of it.
Oh, you
but
couldn't live without your phone.
No, but the rest of it, what you're talking about, I find that...
What, are you scared of a circuit board?
I'm scared of the person who programmed it.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day, I went back to the Traverse Theater, and I wanted to talk to Steph Smith because she, unlike a lot of people at the Fringe, is a local person. I mean, she grew up in Scotland, and she has seen this festival grow in front of her, and the festival has meant a lot to her as an artist.
My first experience in the festival, going way back, started when I was 16, and I was part of a youth theatre group, and a bunch of us, maybe, I don't know, 16 teenagers, we all wrote a show together and performed it for a week in the festival, which, when you're 16, feels pretty darn rock and roll. It was my first taste of the festival, first time I went to the festival, actually, and I think at that point I knew that the Edinburgh Festival was something really special. Edinburgh doesn't sleep for the whole month. There's street performers everywhere. You know, you turn a corner and there's another piece of theatre happening. You turn another corner, there's another piece of theatre happening. It's sort of like Carnival, but I suppose with more established theatre happening in the background somewhere.
The Fringe has taken Smith well beyond Scotland.
Flash forward to I'm a recent graduate, and I was part of a show called Roadkill, which opened in the festival that year and won many awards and got lots of critical acclaim. They did a production in Paris and in New York, and it won an Olivier. So it was quite a bizarre first experience.
And it all started at the Fringe.
Absolutely, all started at the Fringe.
Steph Smith is obviously a local artist, but there are performers in Edinburgh from all over the globe, and that includes two of my former classmates from the theatre department at UC Berkeley. Austin Titchener is an actor and a comedian. He's part of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
I've seen a bunch of plays that I thought were terrific, and I can't see them having any commercial life whatsoever.
Yeah, Austin and Reed Martin are in Edinburgh not just to see shows. They've also traveled to Scotland to perform their new show. It's called Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged, and it's essentially a comedy that mashes together all of Shakespeare's play in about an hour and 20 minutes.
Oh, what a beautiful recreation! The very cast of witches and wizards and masters and servants and lovers and fairies and lasses and perverts? You bet your ass. Ah, but pardon, gentles all. Let us ascend the brightest heaven of invention and on your imaginary forces work. Two fairies, both alike in sorcery, in fairy land where we doth lay our play, from ancient grudge break to new rivalry. Where magic scary gets carried away. From forth their frisky fingers, these fairies fatally, foully confuse friends and foes. The lover is crowned, royalty marries, and how we accomplish it? No one knows.
I met with Titchener and Martin after the show in the outdoor pub right behind the theater, and they told me what The Fringe has meant to them.
We started as a Pass the Hat act at Renaissance Fairs in California, and in 87, a friend of the company said, well, you've done Romeo and Juliet in a half an hour, you've done Hamlet in half an hour, you should do the complete works. And somebody else said, and you could take it to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland, the biggest theater festival in the world. And so the guys brought it here in 87 thinking, it'll be a lark and we'll go back to our day jobs. But things, you know, started to roll, and we did our first UK tour in 1990, and then we ran in the West End 92, 93. Presenters from all over the world come and see us here, and so we get a lot of work directly out of Edinburgh, or we get a booking out of Edinburgh that leads to another booking. I'd say about half of our work probably comes from Edinburgh.
There's really no equivalent that I can think of the Fringe Festival. As a spectator, do you guys try to go out and see other shows? Do you actually favor comedy? Since you do comedy, do you go see tragedy? What's in your lineup?
I try to see everything. 2 years ago, I saw 50 shows in 3.5 weeks, and I think I'm going to see a couple more than that this time. I saw this show, Counting Sheep, where the audience is like participating in the Ukrainian civil unrest for the last couple of years and dancing and throwing bricks at the cops, and they're serving you food. And you're looking at this, and I go, I'm not going to see this anywhere outside of Edinburgh. It's
great. Right.
So I went out and bought tickets for Counting Sheep. It was the last show I saw before I left Scotland, and as it was explained by Reed Martin, it was incredibly participatory. You walk into this theater, and there's a big dinner table set in the middle of this room, and you sit down, and the servers come around, and they are serving you some salad, there's some bread and butter. And very quickly, the scene changes dramatically. There are these projection screens kind of above the dinner table, and they start showing footage from the Ukrainian Revolution of late 2014. Very quickly, the people who are playing music as you're eating your meal put on masks, and they become part of the uprising. Other actors come out, and they're playing the military that is trying to quell the uprising. And the tables are overturned and turned into a barricade, and you're given the tabletop as an audience member, and you're holding a shield, and you're throwing fake bricks at the military, and you become part of the revolution. And you're jostled around, you're pushed and shoved, and at one point, there was somebody who I was certain was a member of the audience, who was Ukrainian. And there's a character in the play who dies as part of the uprising. And this audience member was so overcome by grief that he knelt at the side of this body and started crying. It was completely unbelievable. As the host of The Frame, I spend a lot of time seeing shows and movies. Maybe it's theater one night, a film the next, maybe an art opening, a concert over the weekend, so on. Yeah, it's a pretty cool job, but it's also that. It's a job. And I'm constantly thinking about the interview that might follow or what or who we can put on The Frame to tell a story. And that part is a little scientific. Maybe it's even a little sterile. But what is it like to enjoy a performance just for the show itself, to be as present in the audience as the performers are on stage? Where had that part of the equation gone? So it was something that was nagging at me just a little bit, and I think it's ultimately why I packed up my wife and 2 sons and went to Scotland. So what was the most memorable thing I did or saw in Edinburgh? I think it's impossible to say, really. There was so much that was so good. I will say, though, rediscovering that unbelievable, inexplicable emotion of being transformed by art, by performance, by music, by comedy. It's why I was a theater student in college, and I guess it's why I host this show.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. You can subscribe to the Frame podcast or listen to it live on KPCC in Southern California or online at kpcc.org. You can also follow John Horn on Twitter at JGHorn. Then send us your Edinburgh impressions via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also engage with us and other fans on Facebook or Twitter. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Austin Titchener. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, local Edinburgh lass Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Angela Pym. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to National Public Radio's Robert Siegel, who first invited us onto NPR when he interviewed us for All Things Considered. Thanks, too, to John Horn for the great conversation and for letting me include his piece from The Frame in this episode. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 510 1530ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
And seeing Reed and I do William Shakespeare's long-lost first play at Bridge today, did it make you want to get back up there and do funny voices?
Oh, no.
Not at all. I was noticing he had a kind of similar reaction as he had the night that he didn't go see the Cherry Orchard.
Right? That's right.
Yeah.
Get me out of here.
Yeah.
Where's the exit? I was in the middle of a row. I couldn't get out. I would have to walk over a lot of old people, and it would have been a scene. You would have noticed. That was the worst thing. You would have seen me. There goes John Horn. We went to college with him, but he hates our show. Bye, John. Awkward.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less.